You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM, as I just mentioned. Sorry, we had some technical hiccup at the beginning of the show, so we're starting a few minutes late. We are the News Collective's alternative and undercovered program focused on local Vancouver and Lower Mainland current affairs. Today is National Day of Indigenous Peoples.
I'm Andy Laidman, and today we're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus, as usual, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Haka Miam-speaking Musqueam peoples.
And I'm Alex DeBoer. Today on Democracy Watch, we're, of course, focusing on Indigenous stories, and we're lucky to have in studio our old News Collective comrade, Rema Tulashek, joining us to talk about some reporting he and his classmate, V. Wells, did on a Heiltsuk language revitalization project. This reporting was done as part of the UBC Journalism Program's Reporting in Indigenous Communities class. After that, we're going to turn to a fascinating interview that News Collective member Andy Laidman, who's reading headlines with me, did with Cree scholar and activist Harlan Pruden. Pruden discusses the nuances of what it means to be a two-spirited Indigenous person and how that identity is not as simple as being simply queer and Indigenous. But first, we have headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
First superhero series for Indigenous girls launches today. The first Indigenous superhero series, Fierce Girls, created for Indigenous girls, launches today. The show, which is a transmedia project, aims to create, change, and empower young Indigenous women. Viewers will be able to watch it on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and other social media platforms. Fierce Girl is a co-production of Tangwenu.com, an independent Maori news and information portal in Aotearoa. It is also funded by the Canadian Media Fund. You can find Fierce Girls at fiercegirls.tv.
Indigenous consent needed for resource development. A Resource for Future Generations conference in Vancouver recommends taking a step beyond the existing standards of First Nations consultations when it comes to resource development in Canada. Lawyer Cynthia Callison says First Nations should be consulted and accommodated when they have Aboriginal title in an area under development. She argues this will result in better decisions that balance the distribution of benefits from development. That would mean Indigenous communities wouldn't have to go through courts to prove title and could do planning to maintain environmental protection, cultural and economic development.
Federal government promises to consult with Heiltsuk people on coastal development. The federal government is to seek discussions with First Nations before any project approvals on BC's North Coast, a statement expressed by Prime Minister Trudeau in Prince Rupert on Thursday. The Government of Canada and the Heiltsuk peoples have formally agreed to tackle conservation of oceans, development of marine project areas, increasing emergency preparedness, and boosting First Nations response capacity as part of the federal government's $1.5 billion Oceans Protection Plan. However, Trudeau has been condemned by some First Nations for the expansion of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. The federal government is moving forward with the intention to purchase the existing pipeline from Kinder Morgan and proceed with its construction. This project will have a tremendous impact on the coast.
And City Council in Vancouver approves Affordable Housing Endowment Fund. Today, Vancouver City Council approved the creation of a $2 billion Vancouver Housing Endowment Fund. This fund is mandated to preserve and grow affordable housing in the city and will include city-owned and city-operated land. The fund will be used to build a target of 27,000 new homes over the next 10 years. That breaks down to 7,200 new homes every year. The fund will also aim to provide 12,000 social supportive and cooperative housing units for lower and middle class households. The Affordable Housing Endowment Fund is part of a newly approved financial strategy, which is meant to help council achieve its Housing Vancouver targets. Housing Vancouver is the City of Vancouver's 10-year housing strategy. This was passed about 6 months ago. This strategy also has a major focus on encouraging additional rental developments to be built and on using the city's new authority provided by the provincial government to zone four rental-only areas.
The City of Vancouver recently changed the name of two plazas in the city, and we've just pulled a video up here from the City of Vancouver that will explain how to pronounce these new names.
The name in Hunt Kaminum is Xutlanak.
The name is Xutlank. Shutlunk.
Shutlunk in Hunkaminum, it means a place to have gatherings, to have ceremony.
Shutlunk is a Squamish word that we've created for this square in the city of Vancouver. The meaning of the name is related to a place of cultural gathering.
Humathquiam, Salewatak, and Squamish are part of the Coast Salish peoples, and our ceremonies and our gatherings were the places where many things were exchanged. Information about people's names and weddings would happen, but also things that took place in ceremony became our laws as well and became our truth.
The reason to, I think, to learn this word is to recognize that there is another language besides English and French that is here in the city of Vancouver. And it also gives recognition that people that live in different parts of the world will also endeavor to learn the language of the land.
In Canada, there are over 60 Indigenous languages, 50% of which are in British Columbia, and two of which are in the city of Vancouver. The renaming of the Vancouver Art Gallery Plaza to Shutlunk Square is an example of the work that our three nations are doing with the city of Vancouver to give visibility to the cultures of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. When Vancouver was founded, a lot of the history of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh people was not considered in the development of Vancouver. That this territory is our territory, and we have no treaty with the Crown or with Canada. And so the land still belongs to our people.
Naming of this plaza and many other things within the city in the Hunkaminum language is a real commitment towards recognizing the indigenous peoples of this land that still live here and were here before the creation of the city of Vancouver. And it really truly speaks of reconciliation in the sense that we're working together.
I think the city of Vancouver would be a far more interesting place if the two indigenous languages of the city were thriving and would make the city a far more unique place.
And those plaza names are for the Queen Elizabeth Theater as well as the Art Gallery Plaza there in downtown Vancouver.
Cool, yeah. I think, did the city make that video?
That did, yeah. That was made by the city of Vancouver there.
Great, cool. Also, just another headline or shout out to National Indigenous Day at Trout Lake. If you're looking for something to do right now and you want to learn about local Indigenous nations, there's lots of events happening there. So head down to Trout Lake, which is near Commercial and 12th. Great. So those were your headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We are the News Collective, and we have a special guest with us today. That is, this person is our old friend, Rema Tulashek, who has been very involved in the News Collective during the school year and was away doing an internship at CBC. So we're very lucky to have him back with us. On National Indigenous Peoples Day, CITR's News Collective and the whole station, as you know, recognize and celebrate the many cultures and languages rooted in First Nations heritage that give Canada its unique identity. To explore the story of one of these languages, we have with us Rema Tula. Rema Tula, it's good to have you back.
Well, thank you so much for the warm welcome. Alex, always good to be back home.
I'm glad that this is home. So let's look at what you have for us today. This story is one that you reported on as part of the Reporting in Indigenous Communities course at the UBC School of Journalism. The story was published as part of the More Than Words series and also went live on CBC Indigenous, so feel free to check out the original story there. So can you tell us a bit about the story that you worked on here?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a group project, and I and my co-author and colleague at the School of Journalism, V. Wells, worked on this story extensively. And in a nutshell, the story is about Elizabeth Wilson, a student at UBC's NITEP teaching program. She set out on a journey to launch Vancouver's first urban Helsuk language classes. But her journey was not all that easy. And you know what? I think we should allow her to introduce herself in her own language.
Hi, I'm Emma Ng, and welcome to CITR 101.9 FM at the UBC Point Grey campus, located on... I
think it's a slight technical misfire.
That was a slight technical misfire. Let me get up the correct clip.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. I'm thankful you're all here. Eichtsimga is my name. Well, Eichtsimga is my traditional name. My Ramshuagala Klanuba, Liz, Elizabeth. So that's where my name is. Eichtsimga Klanuba. My name is Eichtsimga.
Well, you just heard from Elizabeth Wilson, and she is the main character of a story. She's a soft-spoken but resilient 39-year-old mother of four children.
And can you tell us a little bit about the First Nation community she belongs to and their place in Vancouver's Lower Mainland?
Right. So the Helsik Nation is in the community of Bella Bella. It's a beautiful place. It's about an hour and a half by plane from Vancouver. Elizabeth is from Bella Bella, and she came to Vancouver as a student. She believes there are anywhere between 50 to 80 people from her community right here in the city. And a census conducted in 2016 suggests that there are less than 15 people from the Helsuk community who can speak their language.
That's interesting. Not very many. And before she arrived in Vancouver, where did her story begin in being proficient in the Helsuk language?
Yeah, so it actually begins in the Bella Bella Community School long before she arrived in Vancouver. She discovered her language sometime in 2001. She was working as a substitute teacher at the school. She heard Helsuk being spoken within the classrooms amongst students and teachers, and soon enough, she started falling in love with it. We asked Elizabeth to explain this process of falling in love with the language. Take a listen.
It just came natural. It was just something that I felt deep in my heart and instantly came out. And yeah, it just, everything else seemed to happen one step at a time. And it gradually came together. Well, not gradually, but quickly came together. Next thing you know, I'm sitting in the classroom learning along with the students, and then being asked to substitute in the language classrooms to becoming a full-time staff member of the language department. I believe I was only in that department for 2 months, and then one of the other language teachers had to leave the program, like, on the spot. So essentially they said, okay, well, you're taking that position and you're going to teach grades 5 to 7 for the remainder of the year. So I'm like, okay, I've been teaching since.
So Elizabeth brings this passion for the language to Vancouver, but is there a moment in Vancouver that turns this passion into a conviction to share the knowledge?
Yeah, so V and I, we both were looking for that moment, and we were wondering, what is there something, one pivotal moment that changed everything for her in Vancouver? And you know what, Alex, there actually is one such moment, and it takes place at her home in Vancouver. It's a beautiful moment. It's best heard from Elizabeth.
Laying in my son's bed with him, putting him to sleep, just talking with him, and we were counting in the language, and we were going over, I believe, the weather in our language, and body parts, and I think we ended up singing the head, shoulders, knees, and toes song in our language, and I think that's when it really hit me, because he said, well, I wonder how many kids that live in the city even know our language. And and I knew the answer was very little, like slim to none kind of thing. And I left him to sleep, and I went into my living room and sat down. I was like, wow, that kind of really hit me. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm here and I'm able to teach my children what I've learned at home. Why not teach people that are wanting to learn it that are living here in the city?
Well, that's really nice. So her son made her think about other people in the city. But is there a strong enough demand from the urban Hadza community to learn their language?
Yeah, that's a valid question. For something of this sort to be sustainable, you need to have a consistent demand and people really eager to learn that language. So Elizabeth told me that she went on to Facebook to see if there's an urban Hadza page. And while she's doing this, word gets around of her arrival to Vancouver. Let's listen to her.
I saw someone post on what the Facebook page called Urban Hadzik, and I've also gotten like private messages saying, "Oh, I see you moved to the city. Are you going to be taking or teaching any classes, or are you willing to?" kind of thing. So it took me a bit because moving to a city with my family was new, and I wanted that process to be able to be fully settled before I had really jumped the gun and said, okay, yeah, class is starting here on this date, this time kind of thing. And because if I knew the first apartment we were in was going to be our apartment for as long as we needed it to be, I would have started extremely, like, right away. But because I knew we were going to have to eventually move out of there, I kind of wanted to wait for that time to come and go, to start the process. And then, yeah, there's a few people who were becoming and are becoming extremely impatient with it, and I understand. Like, I wanted it to start quite a while ago as well, but like I said, it's been a process. So I wanted it to start off without any glitches, any stress kind of thing. But yeah, it sounds like we may have secured a spot.
So Elizabeth refers to people who are eager to take these Hadzik language classes. Can you give a sense of who these future students are?
Yeah, so we did go around looking for these students. Both V and I had the opportunity to interview one of them. Her name is Wanda Christensen. She is a 64-year-old survivor of the residential school system. She had been in touch with Elizabeth from the beginning and was extremely eager for the classes to start. And to really understand the significance of this Hadzik language class and what it really means to the community, I want to share something with you that Wanda said to us during the interview.
At a residential school, I was only a number. This will give me an identity, cleansing my heart, my mind, and my soul due to the soul loss. My life's healing journey has brought me to this stage in learning. I would like to learn the language to gain my right back that was denied me with my culture, which I believe language is a part of. Language is learning about Hadzik custom values and ways of being, and will culturally and spiritually strengthen families and communities, individuals. I also would like to learn language so that I can or may become an instructor to others who wish to learn. I believe that when I am a fluent speaker, I will have an understanding of my participation in traditional activities, such as ceremonies, such as potlatches, tombstone feasts, and settlement feasts. Like, I won't be just sitting there as a witness and community member in the audience. I will be able to participate.
Well, that's very heartfelt and touching. So while there are people for whom these classes hold so much significance, such as Liz Wilson here, and then there's those people who are willing to provide classes, what's really stopping this Heltsuk language class from happening?
Yeah, well, there were many setbacks that Elizabeth had to endure. Consider that the first class was proposed for sometime in October last year. And when we were speaking to Elizabeth during the time of reporting this story, this was March this year. So when we met her in March, she still wasn't sure when the first class would take place. We asked her what the main challenges were, and this is what she had to say.
Finding the proper space where everybody can go comfortably, making sure that space has everything that the class will need to, essentially for me to be able to teach, and for the students to have access to other means as well, and the cost of the room as well is. Well, that's a major issue, is finding funds to cover the cost of using a room. It's kind of different because in Bella Bella you can go to the health center or the elders building or the college or even the community school and say, well, I would like to have a weekend class or an evening class, and they would want. Of course, they would support it, and they'd be like, "Yeah, for sure," and wouldn't cost anything.
Yeah.
So it's definitely different, because that was the one thing that I quickly came to me when I'm like, "Okay, I'm gonna teach a class here in the city," and I'm like, "Okay, where am I gonna hold this class, and what is it gonna cost me?" Kind of thing.
Okay, so it's unclear where the class will be held and when. When you guys were reporting on the story, can you tell us what was going on?
Yes, so since this was a story V and I were following closely, we were waiting with bated breath, along with Elizabeth, hoping for a breakthrough, for a miracle from somewhere. We were constantly in touch with her to see if there was any progress on that front. And then, one evening, I get a text from Elizabeth. We finally had a breakthrough. The Huihua Library at UBC, which is right next to the Longhouse, stepped in to help Elizabeth. They offered one of the rooms in the library for the first class. On that day, 13 members from urban Heltsuk community turned up, and one quickly got a sense that the room wasn't really large enough to accommodate them. So they would have to look for a bigger space for future classes. But for now, everything was falling into place for Elizabeth, for the students, for everyone. So Vancouver's first independent urban Heltsuk language learning class was underway on March 31st, 2018. And what a moment that was.
That sounds great. Not only did she find a space, it wasn't even big enough to hold all the students initially.
And that's a good problem to have.
That is a very good problem to have. So why don't you take us there?
All right, then. So here are some sounds of Vancouver's urban Heltsuk community gathered together to learn the language. It was led by Elizabeth Wilson. Now, you'll notice, Alex, that this isn't a traditional language class, but in a way, a platform for the community members to reconnect with each other and share lighter moments.
Clinta.
Clinta.
Yadin.
Yadin.
Nusi.
Nusi.
Tzinikla.
Sneakla.
Salsa.
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 Tisla. Then Evelyn thought that too. And then Phyllis was like, nope. So we'll go your way, because there's more than more than one occasion it's been said the way he said it. I was yes. Can you say it again?
It's just simple. Tisla.
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 Tisla. Tisla.
Well, those were the sounds from the first Urban Helsuk class. And before I sign off, some bonus material for our listeners. If you're wondering what the head, shoulder, knees and toes song, the bedtime song that Elizabeth sang to her son that you just listened to, if you're wondering what that sounds like in the Helsuk language, then here it is.
All right, so that was Rema Tulashek, along with a story that was reported also by V. Wells, another UBC Journalism School student. And the story was about Vancouver's first Urban Helsuk language learning class. It was first reported for the CBC, so if you want to hear more about that story, check it out on CBC Indigenous. We are now going to take a short break, and then we're going to hear more original reporting on CITR's Democracy Watch. So stay tuned. It is National Day of Indigenous Peoples, and we have more original content coming up, including an interview done by News Collective member Andy Laidman with a Cree activist and scholar about being Indigenous and two-spirited. So stay tuned.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change. BC government now covers medications that could reduce your chances of contracting HIV by 90%. PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis and is a preventative measure that HIV-negative folks can take to reduce their risk of becoming positive. Health Initiative for Men suggests that if you have had sex with a partner with HIV, have had a recent STI, have multiple sexual partners, have a history of inconsistent or no condom use, are currently involved in sex work, or have had repeated courses of post-exposure prophylaxis, then you might want to think about looking into PrEP measures. CATR and Discorder are not medical professionals. Please refer to your doctor for more information.
All right, and we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening on a day of special programming. It is National Day of Indigenous People. So we've had Indigenous programming all day. So that means music, interviews, documentaries, all different types of stuff produced by and for Indigenous people in Canada. And so we have today on Democracy Watch, we did headlines and then we did an interview with a CITR reporter and UBC journalism student, Rema Tulashek, on a Helsuk language revitalization course. And we are now moving on to an interview done by News Collective member Andy Laidman with a Cree activist and poet named Harlan Pruden. And in this interview, he discusses the nuances of being Indigenous and two-spirited and how it's actually much more complex than simply being queer and Indigenous, which is a mistake that a lot of people make. So let's take a listen to this interview, and then we have Andy in the studio, so we'll chat a bit with her about what it was like conducting the interview and doing research after it plays. So here we go.
The voices of Two-Spirit people are sorely lacking in conversations surrounding queer Indigenous philosophies. To learn more about what is needed for these voices to be heard, I spoke to one of Vancouver's prominent Two-Spirit activists.
My name is Harlan Pruden, and I am First Nations Cree. My mother is from the Beaver Lake Indian Reserve. My father is from the Saddle Lake Indian Reserve. Two different reservations, but same Treaty 6 territory in northeastern Alberta. And I am now work, play, and live on the Coast Salish people, specifically the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples here in what we would call Vancouver.
In non-Indigenous culture, there's this misconception that it means one thing. It's a very box idea, but that's not what that means to you at all.
No, it does not. The way that I look at Two-Spirit is that Two-Spirit is a placeholder, or another way of looking at it is Two-Spirit is a community organizing tool and or strategy. And it is used to identify those individuals that we would say that are Indigenous to Turtle Island and lay somewhere on the gender spectrum and or the sexual orientation spectrum. And when you have the intersectionality of those two major concepts, it opens up the possibility for that individual to answer the call of Two-Spirit. So if you're not Indigenous and you're not LGBTQ, GNC identified, then you can't use the term Two-Spirit. So we're walling it off so that we can organize that community. But then once they answer that call, then it becomes a nation-specific conversation. So in my language, I would not have been known as a man or a woman. I would have been known as an Iyakwe. And so that's how we say Two-Spirit in Cree. And then the work is within a decolonizing framework and also centering one's indigeneity, that it becomes this conversation of what does it mean to be a Iyakwe? Who is a Iyakwe? And what is my role and purpose as an Iyakwe for my Cree people?
What role have you taken on as an Iyakwe?
As a mediator, someone who swoops back and forth, you know, like I'm in public health, I'm in health work for my community and working for a better tomorrow for our community. You know, there's many, many things that I do.
I know when we first chatted a few weeks ago, you mentioned that in order to continue the process of decolonization and to continue healing within communities, it was really important to make space for Two-Spirit people, because that's been lacking. Do you mind touching on that a bit?
Sure. I think that what you bring up is a really incredible point. And I take, because I'm an activist, I take a really kind of like a hard stand around this conversation. And that's just because of living in New York for so long. But what I work under this framework that if we are forced to identify as a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, gender nonconforming, gender non-binary, Native person or Indigenous person, is that I take that as an act of colonization. Because we don't have those concepts within our language. Like for a Iyakwe, it translates into one who dresses like a woman. And so many of the programs and outreach material as well as funding mechanisms is only for LGBTQ people. So where do we see the creation of that space for our Two-Spirit people and our ways? Because we are speaking a completely different language. And then I also take a stance that if we as Native people only identify as LGBTQ because we don't know of our teachings and we don't know of our ways, like when I know that I'm highly privileged when I say Niha Iyakwe in my own language, I am Two-Spirit. But if we don't know those teachings and we don't know those ways, I take that as an act of self-colonization. And we must work to educate so that people can free their hearts and their minds so that they know that there is a time in which that we predate these Western ways and these concepts like LGBTQ, GNC, or gender non-binary, or whatever we want to use as a of those other identities. We only see programming for LGBT people or LGBTQ people. I take that as an act of colonization. That becomes a site of its colonization today. Also, if we do not know who we are as Native people and we don't know our teachings, I take that as an act of self-colonization.
I asked Harlan about the responsiveness of Vancouver's Indigenous queer community to Two-Spirit people.
I believe it still needs a little bit of work. I know that great strides have been made. Like, if you look at community, they now have a tagline. It used to just be the home of Vancouver's queer community, but starting 18 months ago, they changed and they made the legal change to community, home of Vancouver's queer, trans, and Two-Spirit communities. And then they've also gone as far as to hire an Indigenous staff member so that the community sees themselves reflective within the name of the organization and their tagline, as well as when they walk in, there's Native staff members. They see themselves within the organization. And I think that's a really good, positive example, right? But I have also witnessed and seen many other folks that, like, just tag on 2S to the acronym of LGBTQ GNC, and they just say tack on 2S, right? But yet the framing and the conversation is not inclusive of us. They're treating us like LGBT Native people. They're making us bend to their ways. So there's also, you know, that's an example of, like, that's colonization, right? If you just are in name only adding Two-Spirit, but you're still talking to us as gays and lesbians who happen to be Native and use that same Western framework, that's colonization. And it's also tokenism, and also I think it's a little insulting when people just tack on Two-Spirit, but they don't actually make the accommodations for us, because we have a unique position and a unique conversation. Simple things like you cannot make pronouncements like the birth of the gay rights movement was June 27th, 1969, right? Qualify that as in the birth of the non-Native gay rights was that. Prior to colonization or, you know, contact, whatever you want to call it, right? There was a time on this land that people who were engaged in same-sex civil marriages had full equality and citizenship and were honored, respected within their communities. But as a result of colonization, they were pushed from their people, ways, and land. You know, what I'm also directly want to say here is that when people who are not Native, when they're offering a pathway for salvation or a pathway for equality, that call is not inclusive of that history that we were here before them. It runs the risk of being this presumption of innocence. You know, and they're like, here, this is our pathway for equality and this is a pathway for salvation, right? But if they don't include us, what they're basically saying, and they're not copping to the fact that it is because of their Western ways that totally messed it over for us as Two-Spirit people. And you're going to get a completely different conversation and a framing for any pathway for equality or salvation when that begins with us as Indigenous and Two-Spirit people, because they're going to have to change their conversation, as well as the historical significance. It's going to frame the conversation differently. But it is also what reconciliation is asking them to do, where so many people rush in and they want to do good deeds and they want to, like, fight for LGBT and queer rights, and they want to gloss over this history of us as Two-Spirit people. And that's where I say there's this implicit presumption of innocence. They're not innocent. Their Western ways, that history, totally messed it over for us as Two-Spirit people. Listening, I think, is one thing, but two, there is something that is active within reconciliation. You cannot think of yourself out of reconciliation. So reconciliation for non-Native people is for them to know our history, their history, so that they are not washing their hands and there's a presumption of innocence. They must know this history. Then what they have to do is to accommodate and create space for that history, that experience, for us who are Two-Spirit. And then when they create a space of that reality and of that history and that experience, they are going to fundamentally have a different discourse and a different conversation, because they're not going to be making these broad, swathy, like, here's the pathway for equality, or this is the pathway for, no, that's yours. I don't know what that conversation would look like, because that's what their work is that they were like, wow, there was a time in which that there were people that were engaged in same-sex civil marriages and who had full equality and were for, what did that system look like? And what is the relevancy of that within a contemporary setting? And what is the application or the utilization of that experience?
And what kind of applications do you envision at the community level, at the city level?
Like, I think that there has to be some sort of attentiveness for my Cree ways. I can only speak for my Cree ways in that, you know, for our Cree people, we had four genders, right? So how do we have a conversation that is inclusive of four different genders? And also it is like getting to know the Coast Salish people here in Vancouver, getting to know what, how they conceived of Two-Spirit. So it may be more than two genders. We have to dig in and do that work. And then when you have that knowledge of the folks, you're going to have a much more subtle, rich, nuanced conversation, and it will not be within this Western binary way. So that, I think, is that's what reconciliation is asking us to do, is to reconcile this history, but then to apply that history within a contemporary or a modern day setting that is not replicating those systems of oppression that were used to mess it over for us as Two-Spirit people, but just us as Native people.
One of the many roles that Harlan takes on is editor of the Two-Spirit Journal.
It is a multi-platform, interactive Two-Spirit news site. So what's really kind of cool about this site is it's for the community, by the community. So if you don't know anything about Two-Spirit, the site is not really going to help you because, you know, we know who we are. And so we just skip to straight content of like, oh, these are some happenings that are happening within the community. It's kind of a unique experience and that we don't define who we are because we kind of know who we are.
You mentioned that the Two-Spirit Journal was more for people that were Two-Spirit themselves. Are there resources that you want to direct people to if they want to learn more about the Two-Spirit community?
There are multiple webinars of recordings. So I think like the Department of Education at the University of Alberta recorded, and there's like an hour-long lecture that has been videotaped and it's up online. And I think you just type in Harlan Pruden UBC and it'll take you right to that. And there's also books, there's movies. What I will do is later on is I'll do a post on a Two-Spirit resource directory, and I'll just pop it up on the site so that people, if they go there, they can like download the Two-Spirit resource directory that's chock full of information on webinars and conversations and selected bibliography and trainings. And so I'll later on, what I will do is make sure that there is a live page for the Two-Spirit Resource Directory.
Harlan provided me with some final thoughts on both his identity and the greater context of reconciliation.
When someone asks me, who are you? I don't think of gay, I don't think of Two-Spirit. What comes out of my mouth first is, I am Cree. That's who I am. But within that statement of who I am as a Cree, I see myself as a Yahqueh and Two-Spirit. Secondly, is that for reconciliation, is that I know that the calls to actions, the 94 calls to actions, don't include a specific bullet or gay, lesbian, or trans and bisexual Native folks are not included in the 94 calls to action. However, in my reading of it, is that because we're not asking for a separate space and a separate standalone, it is about reclaiming and restoring our place of honor and respect for our Two-Spirit people, a mending of the sacred hoop. If you take, for example, the 14th recommendation around language preservation and retention, we cannot be selective in what language and or what is preserved. And so I've collected about 130 terms within our own Indigenous languages that name and call out and identify our Two-Spirit people. So the 14th recommendation speaks to that of like saying reclaim and restore those words like Ayakwe, Ihamana, Agukwe, Winkde. All of those words of who we are as Two-Spirit people is included in that 14th recommendation. So when I read the 94 calls to action, is I see myself completely infused in all 94. And I think that for LGBT, queer, non-Native organizations, I think what they have to do is they have to engage and look at those 94 recommendations around the implementation and embracing and the operationalizing a lens of reconciliation.
And that was Harlan Pruden speaking of the place of Two-Spirit people within frameworks of decolonization and the queer community. I'd like to sincerely thank Harlan for agreeing to take the time to speak with me and share his knowledge.
All right. Well, that was very, very interesting. Andy, you are here in studio. Thank you for sharing that interview with us. We have about 8 minutes left in the show, so I just wanted to ask you a few questions about your reporting process. First of all, How did you find Harlan? He seems like such an intelligent, well-spoken person, like, to stumble upon someone who can discuss these issues with such seeming ease. I'm just curious how you connected with him.
Yeah, so Harlan's a really interesting guy, and I actually met him. I'm a member of Amnesty International, and we had our BC annual general meeting back in May, I believe, and he was actually a speaker at one of our panels.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really interesting. He came in and spoke about, it was a queer rights panel, and he provided some really, really valuable insights on that. And we were just kind of chatting on the break, connected a bit, and he gave me his card and, you know, if he ever wanted to speak again. And then I had this idea to interview him for this project, and it worked really well, and I'm really glad that he agreed to do it.
Awesome, yeah. And so he's Cree, so he lives in Alberta?
He's actually based in Vancouver.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So he just comes from a Cree background, but he lives in Vancouver now.
Oh, awesome. Great. So then how did you prepare for this interview? Like, what kind of research did you do? Are there a lot of resources available on two-spirited identities in Indigenous cultures?
So one of the really interesting things that I came across while prepping for this interview was that when I was looking up Two-Spirit activists and Two-Spirit in general in Vancouver, Harlan's name was actually the one that just kept popping up over and over again. So that was really neat. He's got he seems to have his fingers in a lot of different places. Which is really amazing that he's doing such fantastic work. In terms of like the preparations, I mean, I did speak to him at the annual general meeting and kind of had a pretty basic, I guess, idea of what it was he did and his beliefs and stuff. But getting a chance to go a bit deeper with him through the interview was a really, really incredible process. And we hadn't really spoken previously about how language, especially through the 94 calls to action, play into like queer, Indigenous, and Two-Spirit like philosophies, and I found that like incredibly interesting.
That is very interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about these 94 calls to action? They're part of Canada's effort to, it's okay if you're not an expert, but just like they're part of Canada's reconciliation effort, if we want to call it that, or movement with the Indigenous nations that are all in Canada. So how that relates to queer and two-spirited Indigenous people, were there any things that stood out in your conversation about with Harlan about that?
Yeah, so the 94 calls to action are part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. Mm-hmm. And they kind of cover like a broad swath of things to try and bring reconciliation to Canada. One of the things that Harlan was saying is that there is nothing specifically targeting queer,
right,
queer or two-spirit peoples within those recommendations, but he was seeing especially the language ones, which is a large part of it, as being able to bring the queer and especially the two-spirit people back in by returning to traditional languages, which totally do hold a place for two-spirit and for multiple genders beyond just the two that we have in Western communities, Western society, I mean, like for the third and the fourth gender, which will be reintroduced once the language returns to that, and then there'll be cultural shifts that come of that as well.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I thought that was definitely something that stood out to me in his interview, as well as connecting with one of our headlines, which was about the Vancouver Art Gallery and the Queen Elizabeth Theatre renaming parts of their areas, like the plazas on which they're situated, to traditional Indigenous names. And so, you know, that's a really great point and testament to the power of language and its, you know, significance in especially reasserting culture and and more personal identities as well. And also I was just curious of whether you checked out Harlan's website, because it's, I know it's for two-spirited people, but did you get a chance to take a look?
I've briefly checked it
out. Are you looking at it now?
it's a little embarrassing that I haven't done this before.
No, I mean, he said it's not really for like?
No, sorry, that was the Two Spirit Journal that he was mentioning.
Oh,
his
okay.
website himself is just, it speaks about his work.
Oh, okay.
And he was okay. mentioning that he was going to put on additional resources if people did want to look more into Two Spirit, but weren't Two Spirit themselves, and kind of gain like a basic understanding and more of an in-depth as well. But no, his website is it's a bit more than that. I'm just taking a quick peek at it now.
Oh, okay. Okay, I misunderstood then. That's my bad. I also just wanted to ask whether I have been saying he as a pronoun to refer to Harlan, but is that appropriate? Should I be saying they?
Yeah, so when I was speaking to Harlan, that was a subject that came up. And what he mentioned to me was that he doesn't mind which pronoun is used to refer to him. He is comfortable using anything that's said with intent and with respect is something that he prefers. So I've been using he, as you mentioned, throughout this piece and throughout mm-hmm. this conversation with you. Mm-hmm. It's just one of many that he doesn't have a preference, he told me, and it's just one of many that could be applied to him.
So would he also be comfortable with she?
He would, yeah. With okay. she, with they, with, he said it, as long as it's said intentionally and respectfully, with zersh or any kind of variation. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Great. Well, we are a minute to six, so we'll leave it there. That was Andy Laidman bringing you that interesting interview with Harlan Pruden, a Cree scholar and activist, Vancouver-based. This is the conclusion of Democracy Watch, CITR's news collective. And this is our weekly local current affairs show. Also, Aiden is reminding me to do a special birthday shout out to our favorite person, one of them, Dora Duber. Should we sing happy birthday? No, we won't. Oh, Andy's like ready to sing
I'm
happy
so ready.
Birthday.
Let's sing to Dora.
Oh, okay. Do you guys want to?
Okay. Let's do it.
Okay, this is embarrassing. Real
no, this
quick.
This is so fun.
On the count of three, okay. 1, 2, 3.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dora
Duber.
Happy birthday to you.
Woo! Happy birthday, Dora Duber.
You are adorable.
Oh, wow. No one's heard that before. Okay. All right. This was a special hour of Indigenous-centered programming brought to you by the News Collective at CITR. Stay tuned for more programming on CITR 101.9. We have more Indigenous-focused programming. Join us next week. Bye-bye.
Good night.